return. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us. We're going to be talking about money, your money in the thrift savings plan, which my colleague Jack Moore reported recently has just gone over the $400 billion mark. That's a lot of money. My guest today, leadoff guest, is Arthur Stein. He's a financial planner well-known in federal circles and based in Rockville.
Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay. All right. We appreciate you coming down into the studio today.
It.
And your background just fascinates me. Real quickly, you worked on the Hill and you worked overseas in Australia and Botswana?
Yeah. I was an economist for the government of Botswana for 2 years. I was in their Ministry of Finance. I used to negotiate treaties and aid agreements for them and all kinds of things. I was a Peace Corps volunteer then. And then I went to Australia. I taught in a university and I came back here. So on the House Ways and Means Committee, I was a staff economist on the House Ways and Means Committee.
That's wild. And that was in the days when the House Ways and Means Committee was a household word almost, at least in the Washington area.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And now you're handling people's thrift savings plan accounts, among other things.
Well, I'm advising federal employees and helping them invest their money.
Right. Susie Orman was in town recently, and I saw the taping of the show, and she had said she knew all about the TSP. Obviously, she boned up on it, but she knew all about it. And she said, take advantage of that 5% matching max that the government will give you.
Yeah, absolutely. For FERS employees, the first 5% that they contribute to the TSP is matched by the federal government. They put in 5% for you. So if you're putting in less than 5%, you're making a huge mistake because you're passing up, you know, free money. It's like they just increase your income 5%. And, you know, when new employees come in, the default option is they sign them up for a 3% contribution. I don't know why it's not 5, but people should be proactive. They should make sure they're putting in at least 5%.
Right. And they're talking about changing that default to possibly one of the life cycle funds. Have you heard that?
Yeah. There is a bill before Congress. It's passed the relevant committee, and it would make the default a fund that new contributions go into for new employees be what they call an age-appropriate life cycle fund. And they leave it up to the TSP to determine what the age-appropriate fund is. It's a much better choice than the G fund, in my opinion. Over long periods of time, you would absolutely expect one of the L funds to have a higher rate of return than the G fund in most years. Now, not every year. The L funds can and have gone down in value, even on a calendar year basis. But I think for people, you know, who are going to be working for a lot of years, that's a much better choice. And it doesn't mean it's the best choice. You know, the best choice for people is to sit down, figure out how much they can contribute. Hopefully it's a lot more than 3%. And, you know, they could easily be better off by doing a combination of the CS and I funds and maybe some in the F and G funds and just stick to that allocation through good times and bad. And as decades go by, I think they're going to be better off. Because with the L fund, the life cycle funds, they start off 90% in stocks, the C and the S and the I fund. Those are the stock funds. And only 10% in the F and G funds. But they become increasingly conservative as time goes by. And they finally end up in what's called the L income fund, which is going to be only 20% in the stock funds. And 74% in the G fund, the government securities fund, and 6% in the F fund, the bond fund. And it means you end up with 74% of your retirement funds in the TSP fund that is expected to have the lowest rate of return. And I don't think people can really afford that unless they happen to have a lot of money and a very low cost of living.
Right. So your concern is that they're going to the inflation will eat up.
Inflation is going to eat away. And, you know, another mistake that a lot of people make, you know, they look at their TSP account and they think, oh, gee, I got $300,000 in the TSP, so I'll be able to spend $300,000. Well, that's not true. You've got $300,000 minus taxes. So when you take out your $300,000, you might only end up after taxes with around $200,000. And if you have invested in such a conservative manner that your investments have not kept up with inflation, then that's a double whammy and you're really in trouble.
Would it help any if, say that they were going to put me down into this present income fund and I said, no, I want the 2030. Well, that would change the mix, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you can, if you're in, say, the L-2030 fund because you expect to start withdrawing money in 2030 from the TSP to live on, you can switch to the 2040 or the 2050 fund, and that will be, you know, a more aggressive investment allocation. And, you know, just for people who don't know, you know, as I just said, you know, the funds gradually become more conservative. And when we talk about the L40 and the L50 and the L30, that's the year in which the fund hits its most conservative allocation, and then it stays with that allocation forever. And that allocation is called the L income fund, and that's the allocation which is 80% in the F and G funds and only 20% in the CS&I funds, the stock funds.
Right, and you don't like that because of the inflation
factor. To me, it seems too conservative. Because remember, you may start taking money out of your TSP account in 2030 because, let's say, that's the year you retired, but you could easily, you know, be retired for 20 or 30 or in some cases 40 years, and you want money to be available to spend 10, 20, 30 years later. You don't want that money that you need 10, 20, and 30 years from now to be in a conservative investment.
Okay, totally. Take a short break here talking with Arthur Stein. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com. Arthur Stein, a financial planner based in Bethesda. A lot of interesting background and experience. Ellen Corsoya is running the board today for Lauren Larson. Lauren is off gallivanting somewhere, isn't she, Ellen? Yeah. We don't know what she's doing, but wish her well. We're talking before the break about long retirements, and I pick up the Washington Post this morning, look at the sports section, and I see that Connie Marrero, a pitcher for the Washington Senators, the old Washington Senators, is still in retirement in Cuba. He's 102 years old.
No, is that right?
And
yeah.
Baseball pitchers, I assume, retire in their 40s. So he has been possibly retired for 60 years.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, people underestimate how long a retirement they need to plan for. I mean, lots of us have heard, and, you know, I think it's true that the average 65-year-old lives to 83. And so many people then think, well, I'm going to plan my retirement assuming that I die at 83, and this is a big mistake. If the average 65-year-old lives to 83, it means that half those people are going to live longer than that. And, you know, for people who are in good health now, taking care of themselves, of course, feds have great health insurance. And, you know, if you quit smoking, you don't drink a lot, I mean, you have an excellent chance of living into your 90s and beyond. I mean, my dad died at 91. Why shouldn't I outlive my dad by 5 or 10 years at least? I mean, think how much better health care is going to be in 20 and 30 years.
Yeah, well, I think, and particularly too, people in this market, not just Washington, but in the federal market, but they are in many ways in the elite among the country in health and income and education. So they're going to be on the high side.
Yeah, and you know, if you plan for a long retirement, you die early. I mean,
yeah,
that's a personal tragedy, but it's not a financial tragedy. But, you know, if you think you're going to die at 83 or 5 and your money runs out then and you're still alive, I mean, then that's a personal and a financial tragedy, and you do not want to be in that situation.
There's a commercial, I'm sure you've seen it on television, and they start out with a group of people in the center, and they give them yellow tape, and they say, guess how long how much money do you have, and how long do you think it will last you? And nearly everybody underestimates it. You know, they don't have enough money to last their likely time on this earth.
Yeah, and you know, the feds, you're really in a great situation because you have this federal annuity, and of course CSRS has full cost of living adjustment, very high percentage rate. But even FERS employees at FERS Annuity, it's fabulous. It's going to last your lifetime. Cost of living adjustment isn't quite as good, but it's still way better than anything that people have in the private sector, and you've got Social Security on top of that. So you don't have an excuse to run out of money. I mean, you're never going to run out of money. You're always going to have your federal annuity and Social Security payments coming in. What you're worried about is that you're going to hit a period where you need to supplement that fixed income that you have with money withdrawn from your investments. And if you haven't handled your investments correctly, they could run out, and then you're in trouble.
Right, and you have to start making minimum withdrawals. Is it 70 and a half?
Yeah. When you hit 70 and a half, if you're no longer working for the federal government, you have to start making what are called required minimum distributions, not only from the TSP, but any IRAs you have, unless they're a Roth IRA. But it doesn't mean that you have to spend the money. You just have to take it out of that tax-deferred account. And if you don't need it to spend, you can reinvest it, or you can spend it.
You said the magic word there, the Roth IRA. What do you think of Roths and the federal program?
Yeah. Okay, so federal employees now have a choice. Their TSP contributions can either go into their regular IRA or what's called a Roth IRA. And the Roth IRA is named after Senator Roth from,
Delaware.
Mm-hmm. Delaware, who, you know, initially proposed this. The difference is the contribution limits are the same. With the regular TSP, the money that you put in is what's called tax deductible. It reduces your taxable income. So if you put in $10,000 in 2013, your taxable income for 2013 was reduced by $10,000. And years later, when you take money out of the regular TSP, all the money you take out is going to be fully taxable. With the Roth TSP, everything is identical except that the money that you put in is not tax deductible. It will not reduce your taxable income that year. But when you take the money out, there's no tax on it. And this can be a huge advantage because maybe over your lifetime you contribute $100,000 into the TSP. If it goes into a Roth account and, you know, your investments have done very well and maybe now they're worth $250,000, then you traded a $100,000 tax deduction to get $250,000 in tax-free income. And especially for younger people who are, you know, have currently a lower salary than they'll probably have in the future. In the future, you know, if they have a higher salary, higher income, their tax rate is likely to be higher, which again makes the Roth TSP very advantageous. And because the money, when you take the money out of the Roth TSP, not only is it tax-free, it reduces your adjusted gross income because it's not taxable, and it may therefore reduce your Medicare premiums, which go up as your income goes up. And it can reduce the taxes you have on your Social Security benefit because that's based on your income, too. So it can be a lots of advantages to the Roth TSP.
It's now, hard to I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's hard to explain something like to a young person. Oftentimes you don't have money. You're not thinking about 40 years down the road and retiring. But if there was some way you could sit them down and say, trust me, this Roth is it's too good to be true.
Yeah, and you know, it's too bad. I mean, I hate it when younger people especially don't sit down with somebody and get advice because the decisions they make, because they are young, they have a lot of leverage. And the Roth TSP question is a very important decision to make. The other very important decision that lots of younger employees get wrong is, you know, just the investment allocation. I mean, I've seen federal employees and non-federal employees, but say federal employees, you know, who all their TSP contributions are going into the G fund. And, you know, they're looking 20, 30 years down the road is when they're going to access the money. And that's a terrible decision for younger people. They should be much more aggressive investors.
Well, and when you have situations like the market downturn in 2008, 2009, people fled the stock funds, so they sold low. It went into the G fund, which was paying next to nothing. They remained there. Now that stocks are booming again, people are feeling frisky, and they're saying, I want to go back. I want a piece of that action. And so now they're going back, and they're going to be buying high, correct?
Yeah. I mean, people don't do a good job of the average person does not do a good job of managing investments. There have been lots of studies on this. And basically, you know, the average investor, most investors – tend to buy high and sell low, which is the opposite way that you would make money in stocks and bonds. You want to buy low and sell high. It's because they get enthused when the stock market's doing well and they start buying. They get discouraged when it's down and they sell. So they're buying after it's gone up, selling after it's gone down, and then wondering why their investments aren't doing well. And again, you want to find the appropriate allocation and stick with it unless there's some kind of change in your life that would dictate a different allocation.
You know, back in the day, a couple of years ago, before the markets went up and down, there was all this pressure to allow literally day trading in the thrift savings plan, and people could do it. And there were the TSP estimated, I think there were 4,000 to 5,000 people who were or would be regular day traders. And every time we or someone else would publish anything against the or about the evils and dangers of day trading, we get swamped with emails, and they actually set up a newsletter to attack me and other people like me who said that day trading just doesn't work. And several of them called. They weren't hostile or anything, but they were angry. And several of them called or emailed and said they were successful day traders. And I asked them to send me a record of their investments. Never got one.
Yeah, I mean, I find a lot of people manage their own investments always feel like they're doing well, but they don't keep records as to, you know, like what actually was their return on their investments minus expenses last year or the last 5 years. And then, you know, the nice thing about the funds in the TSP and mutual funds and exchange-traded funds is you can find out exactly what the return has been. And day traders don't do that. And, you know, the TSP cracked down on that. They definitely made the right decision. Now you can only make 2 inter-fund transfers per month, except once you've made 2 in that calendar month, you can always switch money into the G fund. But it means you can't day trade, and that was a good decision. It, you know, it's like requiring people to get motorcycle helmets and seat belts. You know, you're requiring them to do something that's good for them, or in this case, you're preventing them from doing something that's not only bad for them individually, but raises the expenses of the TSP and therefore is bad for just the other people who are investing in the TSP.
Jack Moore, Federal News Radio, reported last year that the TSP had commissioned, I guess, Mercer and Company to do a study for them, and that a number of proposals were in the works. They're not necessarily going to happen, but there are a number of proposals. And I think one was emerging markets, and the other was another small cap or international fund.
Yeah, what they looked at is whether additional funds should be added to the L funds, the life cycle funds. And they weren't, I don't know why, but they were not looking at adding the same fund to the, you know, the 5 funds that are already there. You can only invest in this through the L funds. And they looked at emerging markets, international small cap stocks, global real estate investment trusts, and commodities. And what they found was that the one sector that had the biggest effect on the performance of the L funds was emerging markets. So these are international stocks from what we used to call less developed countries, South American countries, you know, countries like China, Cambodia, Vietnam, et cetera. And I actually read the report yesterday, and, you know, Mike, I think I should get more money for reading that report, except you don't pay me money
at
all.
The check is in the mail. So. Let me, just for that, let's take a break here.
Okay, please give me a break.
Okay. We'll be right back here on FederalNewsRadio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. It's Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Arthur Stein. Got a couple more minutes with him. Arthur, we were talking about the Mercer report, and that is some recommendations for things the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, the people that run the TSP, might want to do.
Yeah, so they looked at adding, different investment sectors that are not currently represented or aren't represented in a high enough percentage, I guess. And the one that seemed to make the most sense to them in the sense that it had the biggest increase in performance was what's called international emerging markets, which means less developed countries, stocks from those countries. And what struck me was, one, it really didn't make a big difference in performance on the income fund, the L income fund. It only added 0.1%. And on the L2050 fund, which is where it had the biggest change, it was added about 0.3% or 0.4%, but an increase of volatility in both accounts. The other thing that struck me about the report, then, they were also recommending that the percentage that goes into the G fund be even higher than it is now. And I just didn't get that. I think if they want a greater representation in emerging markets, they could just change the I fund, which is the International Stock Fund, to a different index than the one they're using. The one they're using now is all developed markets, large cap countries, and there's other indexes that include emerging markets and include smaller cap international stocks. I think that would be a good thing. They wouldn't have to change anything else to get that. And as far as like commodities are concerned, I mean, I just think that that's a very difficult product to invest in. You know, if you buy a stock fund, it buys stocks. If you buy a commodity fund, you know, it has to go out and actually either buy timber and gold and potatoes or whatever it is, or it has to buy derivatives that represent those. It's just a much messier. I say keep the TSP simple. Stick to five funds. That's really all you need. You might want to change the index for the I fund. The change that I would personally recommend in the L fund is a lower percentage in the G fund for the L income fund.
Because being safe, in your view, over the long haul is not safe.
Well, when they say safe, they mean that it will be less volatile, mm-hmm. that it won't go up and down in value as much. And, you know, we saw that in 2008, the L2040 fund was down 31% that year. The L income fund was only down 5% that year. So it's not going to fluctuate as much in value. But as a financial planner, you know, my goal and job is to make sure people don't run out of income, run out of investments and income from investments before they die. And that's a much bigger risk than volatility over a long period of time.
Yeah, the old line used to be make sure that your last check bounces, and that's fine if you know what that date will be.
You know, a lot of this, you know, people have to decide, do they think the stock market's going to go down and never come back up, which has never happened in the past. Of course, past performance, no guarantee of future performance. Or do they think that it's going to be like it has been for over 100 years, that when the market goes down a lot, it tends to have a larger recovery and then go on and hit newer highs.
Would you, in that concept, explain dollar cost averaging?
It's hard to explain, you know, over the radio, but basically it says dollar cost averaging is what you're doing every 2 weeks when you're working and investing money in the TSP. And you're buying a fixed dollar amount every 2 weeks, but the cost of the shares you're buying varies. So let's say you are putting money in the C fund and the stock fund. When the stock market's down, you end up with more shares in that, you know, for that 2 week investment. And when the stock market is up, you end up with fewer shares for your two-week investment because it's the same dollar amount. And as a result, you end up with a lot more of the cheaper shares and less of the more expensive shares. and that's advantageous over the long run.
So the people who stayed in the market in 2007, 8, 9 now are looking very good.
Yeah, and, you know, for some of my investment clients, Mike, who have, you know, put all their money in the G fund or maybe a little in the F fund, and they're very nervous, what I suggest is at least for your new investments, put those in the C and the S and the I fund. And, you know, if you're that nervous, leave your money in the G fund, because your investment allocation can be completely different than the current allocation of your existing investments in the TSP.
Sure.
So you could have 100% in the G fund, and then you could tell the TSP, but for my new investments that I'm making every 2 weeks, put all of that in the C and the S and the I fund. And that way, if the market goes down, it's good for you. Because you're
exactly.
buying when it's cheap.
As they say, you want it down every day of your life until you cash in.
And then
theory,
you want it to go up.
Yeah. How do people get in touch with you?
Yeah. So my name's Arthur Stein. I'm in Bethesda. My firm is Arthur Stein Financial. The website is arthursteinfinancial.com, A-R-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-I-N, financial.com. And my email is art@arthursteinfinancial.com.
Art, thank you for coming down. I hope we'll get you down here again. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com talking with the Federal Times folks. Welcome back to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us. And reminder that all of our shows are archived here on Federal News Radio. So if you missed Arthur Stein just a moment ago, or if you want to hear it again or pass it on to a friend, you just go to our archive and click on, and there it is, and all the other shows as well. This is a fun part of the show. We call this Pirate Radio because sometime back some of the Federal Times folks suggested that if things got slow or dull, we just talk in pirate accents and make parrot noises. So welcome to Pirate Radio here. And my guests are Andy Medici, senior writer for the Federal Times, and Nicole Blake Johnson. You with us, folks?
It's good to be here.
Avast that. Listen, we were talking about subjects, things to talk about today, and Andy, you sent one in that said the Postal Service plans to cut 10,000 employees through attrition, which we had heard, but then you said and possibly 85,000 more. Is that a typo?
No, that's not a typo. This is if the Postal Service gets the flexibility it wants through the legislation that's making its way through Congress, they definitely plan on cutting 85,000 people over the next, you know, over the next few to 5 years. They want a workforce that's about 400,000 full-time career and 65,000 full-time non-career workers. So that's, you know, that's 85,000 less than they have right now.
I remember when they had 850,000, maybe more.
Yeah, they've definitely reduced their workforce since 2000. They cut, I think, close to 400,000 positions, and it's all part of their effort to try to cut costs and to, you know, transform themselves into something different for, you know, the new century.
Well, I know when you go into a post office now, they're selling more things, selling items, everything from stamps and albums to mugs and whatnot. But the plan to put people into, was it Best Buy stores?
Oh, yeah. You know, the idea was essentially this third-party realtors and put people in there, and, you know, the unions were very opposed to that. And, so, you know, some of those efforts seem to be on hold, but it's definitely a point of contention in terms of where the Postal Service should conduct its business and who should be conducting it, and that's definitely a point of contention between the unions and the Postal Service itself.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine where the Postal Service is going to be 20 years from now.
It definitely is, but, you know, part of that's definitely going to they're branching out into Sunday package delivery. So if you're that type of person that likes to order online and is frustrated that you can't get packages on Sunday, that's definitely something that they're expanding, and it's actually quite lucrative business for them too. They want to be able to deliver packages to you any day of the week and make their money that way.
And I can understand the logic of this, but it would strike some people as odd that they want to talk about delivering packages on Sunday but not delivering mail on Saturday.
Right, you know, that's another point of contention. They want to cut that letter delivery, that small item delivery on Saturdays, and just expand the package service so that they can boost those sorts of profits. But for a lot of people, that that is something that they don't want to support. And for a lot of older people who still communicate largely through the mail, they'd rather not do that.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. It would be interesting to see a study of what it's going to look like in the future and then be around to see how accurate or how incorrect it was. Nicole, I know you're always looking at IT stuff and cybersecurity and everything. What's going on in your world?
Well, I am. One of the latest topic areas is dealing with GSA and the Department of Defense working together to see how they can incorporate cybersecurity requirements into government contracts. And that was an effort that the White House had pushed for in the president's cybersecurity executive order a year ago. So you have GSA and DoD working together to see how can we come up with requirements. And that's going to take some time. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. But essentially, if you're a government contractor today and you're working on a contract where either A, you have a solution, a device, or a service that requires you to connect to the government's network, or you're transmitting data, you can expect to see down the road more requirements for you to better protect your data. You know, in the case of DoD, they're requiring their contractors, certain contractors, to report if there's a security breach within their walls, because contractors today aren't just storing their own data, they're also storing the government's data.
What about this executive order or legislation that the president has worked on and has announced concerning the NSA and security with phone records and things like that?
Yeah, certainly. There, you know, was a big outburst, especially with the revelations that Edward Snowden released about the NSA's data collection program. And now you have the administration working on a plan that would essentially have the phone companies storing, you know, more of this bulk data, and through use of court orders, the government would be able to query and get information about the data. It's essentially to make the public feel more comfortable that the government just isn't storing all of your phone records and data, and they're able to search through there for whatever information they would want. So, you know, more of a separation between government actually, you know, being able to store large chunks of data, and citizens feeling safe and, you know, knowing that their privacy is not being diminished.
You know, what fascinates me, and you don't have people like Edward Snowden come along every day, but whenever you have a situation where somebody maybe takes a long trip or several trips and then flees and goes off, but leaves their employment, and I think, how are they living? How are they eating? Does he have a rented room at the Y in Moscow? Have you done any research on his life?
I haven't done any specific research, but based on, you know, reports and what I've seen, he doesn't seem to be in a position where he's not taken care of or he's starving. You know, we had talked about this the other week, the
right.
Fact that he, you know, spoke at South by Southwest. So he, you know, is having speaking engagements. He's even done, you know, discussions with the media about the situation. So as far as I know, I haven't heard that he is in a position where he's, you know, he doesn't have any means to take care of himself.
Well, they always say have anywhere from 6 to 12 months of money to take care of your expenses. And I was thinking his case.
And he has many skill sets.
So. Yeah, he does. He does, yeah.
Many skill sets for people to take advantage
and
of.
And a friendly environment, too. What else is going on?
Recently, GSA, they also announced an effort that they're calling 18F, where they have, you know, several people in-house who have skills in web design, programming, and the goal there is for them to be able to help the government move into a position where they function more like a startup company, rather than the government saying, okay, we have this need for a certain IT system, let's take years to build it. Rather than doing that, they're saying, let's start with what we know we need, and then do sprint cycles where, you know, in 1 to 2 weeks, we set goals to say, hey, let's come out with this development so we can put out a system that could be tested and easily fielded, as opposed to taking years and things may not work out.
Andy, in the email you sent me, you said that there's pressure building on the White House to issue an executive order to ban discrimination against lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgenders, that it's building up for federal contractors.
Yeah, that's definitely right. It's for federal contractors. Close to 200 lawmakers signed a letter and sent it to the administration telling him that President Obama should issue an executive order that bans discrimination among LGBT contractor employees. The pressure's been building more because he recently, as we know, signed the executive order to raise the minimum wage among federal contractors. And this is an area where the president has the authority on his own to do this. So a lot of people think that, you know, he should show his support for the LGBT community and ban discrimination where he can while waiting for Congress to pass more general legislation that would apply to the country as a whole.
Now, that's, a moot point in the government because, at least in theory, it's discrimination of that kind or any kind is already banned, correct?
That's correct. It's among contractors that people on the take the action. And while some people say that there are already some contractors that do this, they want something more comprehensive and something that can be enforceable and trackable so that, you know, so that LGBT employees of contractors can feel just as protected and just as safe in the workplace as anyone else.
And just throw something out to the two of you because you are young, and we had a piece the other day about the government working hard to attract younger people. The things the government has to do or should be doing to attract young people. And I've been hearing this since the Grant administration, you know, at least. There's always a crisis every 2 years. It would seem to me that given the economy and given the fact that so many companies are doing away with defined benefit retirement plans and with the uncertainty of things and the number of the jobs that are being recreated are not high-paying jobs, I would think the government would be an employer of first resort for a lot of young people.
Well, I can answer from a technology perspective because this always comes up at conferences where you have companies who are also competing for the same talent and they're offering these younger employees a lot of perks, whether it's, you know, teleworking on a regular basis, whether it's being able to use their own device to get their work done, you know, whether it's being to access data from any device at any time, wherever they are. And those are things that they're used to. You have a generation that grew up, you know, using Facebook, using Twitter, and to know that that's a part of what's required of them at work and, you know, them actually having the room to and being encouraged to bring new ideas to the table, that's very enticing. And, you know, you're in an age in government where you have agencies, they're taking notice of that and they're really trying to get on the ball in terms of, you know, allowing their younger employees room to offer up their good ideas and to be more flexible in how they allow them to work.
So they really are going after them, huh?
Oh, they're certainly going after them, especially in the IT area, cybersecurity, absolutely.
Well, I would guess in some areas, given the security requirements of the government, that Uncle Sam will never be able to keep up with these private companies.
In terms of the pay, it's really hard to do so. And, you know, in the case of agencies like DHS, you know, what they're promoting and offering to these younger people is a sense of mission. You know, you can serve your country in this way if you come join us. Or, you know, there's things that you'll be able to do legally working for DHS as opposed to if you, you know, wanted to go off and do something on the side, that wouldn't be so legal. So the opportunity to work on, you know, really cool cyber projects is what they're offering up.
I wrote something the other day about the fact that it's almost cyclical. You have a government scandal of one kind or another, maybe federal employees abusing government credit cards, you know, hiring prostitutes or buying silly things or having conferences. It's almost cyclical. People never learn their lesson. And then open up the Washington Post this morning. Actually, didn't have to open it up. On the front page is a story of three Secret Service agents and an advance team for President Obama's trip to the Netherlands. And three of them were sent home for drinking.
Yeah, that's definitely right. You know, and the Secret Service has had problems before. That's why the administration's tried to take steps to show that, you know, it's a professional workforce. But at the same time, you know, the government's made up of people just like everyone else. And I think the stricter scrutiny can sometimes yield uncovering things like this before, for example, a private company might. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, people hold government employees to a higher standard. They're serving their country. They're being paid with taxpayer dollars. So I think these sorts of things are much more important to people than, for example, employees doing something similar at, for example, a private security company.
Do you think there's a new puritanism afoot in the country, or are all these gadgets and things like Facebook and Twitter, are there more, are people getting into trouble more, or are they getting caught more?
I think it's a little of both, because you have all of this information and access at your fingertips, whether you're on your desktop at work, whether on your smartphone or on the go, and there's certainly a lot more bombarding you and a lot more for you to get into at all hours of the day. And at the same time, people are getting news and information on their devices in seconds. You can, you know, what you just mentioned about, you know, the situation with the Secret Service officials. I mean, yeah. I got an alert on my phone, you know, immediately after it happened. So I knew about that. And, you know, back to the original question you have, none of that helps in the recruiting process when, you know, these types of behaviors are publicized and we all know about them so quickly. That doesn't help with the public's perception of the federal workforce, although that does not, you know, make a bigger representation of every federal worker, which is
yeah.
just sad.
Good point. Well, listen, thank you. Last word. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Ellen. And thanks, Nicole. We'll see you all here next week, sorry, next Saturday. See you next Wednesday. Have a good week.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.